Yeah, we're looking for people to participate. It's Tuesday, next Tuesday, February 18th, 4:30 to 9:30 out in Chelsea Piers, Pier 60. Definitely looking for people to sign up. There's an event link on campus groups and a Google form where you can indicate what you're interested in. We're not looking for just participants. Anyone to come out, support our team, would be fantastic. And I know there aren't too many MBA ones in here, but for those that are, all participants as well as all attendees, it'll be 25 points toward the block competition. So if you have any questions, definitely reach out to me or Bennett Adams, the MBA one, and looking forward to seeing you guys out there. Thanks.
Thank you. Thirty-five years at NYU, I've never gone to an NYU sporting event. It just doesn't seem.
Professor, you should come too then.
Hey, come on, this isn't Ohio State or Duke, right? I mean, it is what it is. I mean, I'm sure you guys will be sporty on Tuesday and win against law school at least, right? I mean, that's easy pickings right there. Okay? But I wish you the best on that. I'm going to start the next couple of sessions with two questions I started the corporate finance classes with. You know what the two questions are, right? First, who's not in a group yet? Don't feel ostracized. Just put up your hands. And take a look around because you might have the beginnings of a group right here. So I have three hands, four hands. So, no. I will not... I've been asked, will I put you in a group? I am not doing that. I will not take responsibility for what happens afterwards. So I will try to play matchmaker, and usually I succeed. So I will keep pushing you on other groups if need be. So, but put your name down on the orphan list. The second, and this one I want an honest answer. Who's not picked a company yet? Okay. I won't even say what I have to say next. Do it. Okay. So today, I actually, if you notice, I sent an email yesterday. You should probably notice, there's an email every day. In fact, if you don't get an email from me, you should start putting out search missions and all kinds of stuff. But I didn't send you a start of the class test, but it's a bit of a lie because the test for today is going to come in 20 minutes into the class because I want to lay foundations. You have no idea what I'm talking about, right? Don't worry, it's okay. You will see the test when it does come up about 20 minutes into the class. But if you do get a chance also, visit that do-it-yourself evaluation of Tesla because it's not about the Excel spreadsheet. It's about getting perspective. So what I do in that is basically show you what the total size of the automobile market is, what a big company looks like, what margins look like, so that when you first sat down to look at Tesla last Tuesday, you're probably saying, well, why 25% growth? Why not 35%? Why not 50%? Why not 100%? No. Why 12% margins? Why not 20, 22, 24? Take a look at that post if you haven't read it because it gives you perspective. And it shows you why I picked what I did and why I've not picked what I did. Because, again, when I posted that on Friday, of course, I got pushback from people who are either Elon lovers or Elon haters. And one of the comments I got on the YouTube video that I put up, I didn't respond to it. I kind of let it be is, but Elon Musk says we can grow 50 to 100%, that Tesla will grow 50 to 100% over the, he didn't put a time period there, 50 to 100% a year, and at 20% margins. And he said, well, I don't know, why not use 100%? You know what the revenues would need to be in year 10? If you have 100% growth rate, you know what the revenues turn out to be? $3.9 trillion. This is why growth rates are so deceptive, right? Because 100% is saying, what's a big deal, 50%, 30%. So that's why don't focus on growth rates. Look at the dollar values. It'll give you a sense of what you're building in the company. So let's finish off the last part of the introduction. Because if you remember in the last session, we talked about intrinsic valuation. Not for everybody, right? Because you need to forecast the future. You need to value the business. You need a long time horizon. And you also need faith. Faith in what? Price will adjust to it. Then we talked about pricing. Much shorter time horizon, corrections happen sooner. But the problem with pricing is you find something to be underpriced. It doesn't have to be undervalued. You're making a relative statement. There's one final approach valuation that I really didn't get a chance to talk about. And very quickly, I want to wrap up that loose end. We'll come back and talk about it more. which is applying option pricing models in valuation, contingent claim valuation. I know when I say option pricing, your mind goes to Black-Scholes binomial option pricing models, and maybe mine doesn't, but mine does. But when I think about an option, here are the things I see under the surface. First, options are leeches. They derive their value from something else. An option can't live on its own. It's a derivative security. That's the first feature. Second, options have limited lives. You can't have an option forever. They have limited lives. And third, what makes options different is there is a contingency that determines the payoff. In fact, you know the best way to recognize when there's an option is to draw the payoff diagram on an investment. What will happen if the price drops 5%, 10%? And the payoff diagram on options have a very special characteristic. You see what it is? When I have a call option, if stock prices go up, or the underlying assets price goes up, I make dollar for dollar, whatever the price goes up to. But if prices go down, what happens? The most I can lose is what I paid for the options, limited losses. File that away because it's going to drive how you think about options. With put options, if the stock price drops, dollar for dollar, I make money. But if the stock price goes up, there's limited losses. The key to options is my losses are limited to whatever I paid for the option. Now, when you take option pricing classes, of course, you apply these on listed options, on warrants, on convertibles. I'm going to do none of that stuff because that's for another class. So if you want to do convertibles, then a fixed income will do it. Options is an options class. I want to talk about applying option pricing in valuing businesses. And I'll give you some examples of where we will use option pricing. You buy equity in a deeply troubled company. You know that the Indian government is trying to sell Air India, right? You don't buy Air India. Air India is this deeply disturbed airline in terms of how it's run, which has not made money as I don't know how long. You're not buying Air India for the cash flows unless you like large negative cash flows. So why would anybody bid for Air India? Because India is a big market and you're getting a foothold there. And perhaps you can turn around. You're buying an option. That's what the equity in Air India is. It's not a traditional equity. So when you have equity in a deeply troubled company, a money-losing company with a lot of debt, you're buying an option. You're not buying. And we'll talk about applying option pricing to value. Pretty much any airline has an optionality. It could be that you have Petrobras as your company. What does Petrobras have going for it? It's got lots of reserves. What does it have not going for it? These reserves are not in Saudi Arabia. They're under the ocean. They're under shale. It'll cost you $50, $60, $65 to get the oil out. Right now, that oil might not be viable. But you see where there's an option there? If you buy Petrobras and oil prices go up to $100 a barrel, those reserves go from being non-viable to viable. You're basically buying a significant option. You might be buying a company which is a young technology company with a patent to do something, but the patent is completely non-viable right now. It's a big market. Or it could be a drug company, a young pharmaceutical company that's come up with an Alzheimer's drug, but right now it's not viable. But you might still pay for it because it's a big market, and if you can find a way to make it viable, it could be a blockbuster drug. This is what's called real options. And I have mixed feelings about real options becoming part of valuation. There are people out there who've written books on real options, but they tend to be purists who believe that real options apply everywhere. And remember the old Charlie Munger saying, if the only tool you have is a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail. And these people see real options everywhere. I'm a skeptic when it comes to real options. I believe there are uses, but they're restrictive. We're going to talk about those uses. But here's what I want you to take out when we have that real options discussion. You're going to find that option pricing models are stretched to the point of breaking when we value real options. And here's why. Option pricing models were designed to value listed options on the CBOE, typically 3-4 short-term options on traded stock. So the underlying asset is there. You can see the price. When I value a patent as an option, I'm really stretching option pricing models because now I'm looking at a 15-year option on an asset that is not traded. So I'll tell you, when I put an option pricing model to actually put a number on a patent, I'm very uncertain about whether this is a number. So you're saying, why bother? Because recognizing when something is an option is more important than actually putting the option pricing model. Because when you see an investment as an option, it changes the way you think about risk. Let's back up. When you buy a company for its cash flows in a discounted cash flow model, remind me again what happens as those cash flows get riskier. Cash flows get riskier, discount rate goes up, value goes down. So in intrinsic valuation, higher risk leads to lower value. When you're pricing a company, let's say it's a small, risky steel company or a Russian steel company in a market full of other steel companies in other markets. If I increase the risk of the company, I attach a lower multiple to it. And in pricing, risk is going to hurt you. But when you buy an option, risk becomes your ally rather than your enemy. Let me ask you a question. Do you want to buy shares in a deeply troubled, stable company? I'm not even sure what that means. I lost $100 million last year. I can guarantee you I can lose $100 million every year. You don't want that, right? When you buy equity in a deeply troubled company, what do you want? You want volatility because that's the only way you get out from underwater. Risk becomes your ally. And what is it about options that makes risk your ally? I gave away the game and I showed you the payoff diagram, right? What do options have? Limited. Think about risk. Who amongst you complains about upside risk? Have you ever complained, you know what, the stock is so risky, it went up threefold. Upside risk is not risk. You think of it as something you want, but downside risk is the risk we demand a risk premium for. What have I done with options? I've floored your downside. So the key to me with real options is not that option pricing number that comes out of it. It's because I think about how it changes the way I invest. So we'll come back and talk about real options, but when you think about option pricing models in pricing real options, they come with a whole host of issues. And so when we go through these models, we'll talk about what we can do to adjust these models to make them real. But applying option pricing models to value long-term patterns or undeveloped reserves is a much trickier exercise than putting a number on a listed option. But it is true, there are some assets, the only way you can arrive at a value for the equity in the company is to think of it as an option. Every other approach will give you a negative number and no value at all. So bottom line is you look across valuation approaches. Your valuation approach can either be an intrinsic value, a pricing, or a contingent claim approach, a real option approach. There aren't hundreds of models. Basically, there are three buckets into which every one of these models go. And I'm not going to say one is better than the other. But it's good to know all three. It's not exclusive. I see people saying, I do only intrinsic valuation. I won't do pricing. Why? Why can't you do both? Isn't it? I mean, ultimately, what's your end game? It's to make money. Doesn't matter to you whether you make money from a pricing mistake or a valuation mistake? Not really. So I'd like to find things that are both valuation and pricing mistakes. And that's why I think we should spend time talking about all three approaches. Any questions about valuation approaches? What's a buzzing noise? You heard it? What the hell happened here? That's the buzzing noise. No, that's not the buzzing noise. Whatever. I don't know. If something starts, smoke starts coming out, let me know. Now. And let me get out first before you guys make it. So let's start on the first packet. If you haven't bought the packet, don't freak out. You can watch the slides now, get the packet. If you already got the packet, I think you can you still, they don't take it back, right, at the bookstore? Too bad. No. It's not cost. No. But this is what we're going to spend the first half of the semester on, is this packet. So let's start back so the entire packet is going to be about intrinsic value. Let's step back and think about what you're trying to do in intrinsic valuation. In intrinsic valuation, you're trying to put a number on a company, on an asset, an investment, based on its cash flows, its growth, and its risk. That's the key. Everything is based on what you generate. And if you think about it, discounted cash flow valuation is just a tool we use to estimate intrinsic value. So if you think intrinsic valuation started 70 years ago when the first discounted cash flow models were created, the first discounted cash flow model was a dividend discount model from 1938. But people have been doing intrinsic valuation for as long as they've been buying and selling businesses. So I will use discounted cash flow valuation as my tool to estimate intrinsic value, but the core of intrinsic value is your trace value back to fundamentals. So with that set up, let me lay out the fundamentals of valuation. When I give you an asset to value, there are two ways you can do a discounted cash flow valuation. Here's the most common way, and the one you're probably most familiar with. You estimate the expected cash flows in the asset. Expected, not best case, not worst case, not conservative, expected. And then you discount those expected cash flows at a risk-adjusted discount rate. You can call it cost of equity, cost of capital, but the essence is expected cash flows discounted back at a risk-adjusted rate. And I'm sure most of you who've done discounted cash flow valuation, whether it's my class or somewhere else, that's the way you approach valuation. But there is another way in which you can do valuation, and it's almost never practiced. And you're going to see after I describe it why people really don't do it or do it well, or don't do it well. Instead of taking expected cash flows, you could take what are called certainty equivalent cash flows. You're saying, what the heck is a certainty equivalent cash flow? Let's play a game. Let's assume that your expected cash flow next year is $100 million on a risky business. You know what a certainty equivalent cash flow is? What would you accept as a guaranteed cash flow in return for giving up that $100 million? So give me the easy answer first. Will you want, if I gave you a guaranteed cash flow instead of that risky cash flow, would you want less or more than $100 million? You're going to settle for less because you're getting a guaranteed cash flow. You know, if you want to understand certain equivalents, there's a TV show you can watch. It's called Deal or No Deal. Have you watched this with Howie Mandel? Here's how it is. You have two suitcases. One has $1 million, the other has nothing. You're the contestant. Howie will call you up and offer you money. First, what's the expected value across those two suitcases? This is really bugging me. I hate this. Is my microphone, you think? This one? You're right. It's always on. I don't know why it's doing it today. Maybe there's some buzz that came out of the announcement that's carrying over. Right? It could be anything. I don't want to blame other people. Right? So basically, deal or no deal, here's how it works. You got $1 million, zero, two boxes. You can pick one. So what's the expected value? $500,000, right? Howie Mandel will offer you $350,000. Don't be so quick to say no. Why do you say no? $350,000 is less than $500,000, right? But remember, you get $350,000 or you get an expected value of $500,000. So you could turn down the $350,000, and this happens sometimes in the show. You open a suitcase and what do you find? Zero. So this is certainty equivalent in game show version. Imagine valuing Tesla, and I'm Howie Mandel. I come to say, what are your cash flows in year one? $23 million. Would you take $15 million guarantee? And what will determine how much you will ask for? How risk-averse you are as an individual. That adjustment from expected value to certain equivalent is really, it's not impossible. There are ways you can get around it. But the information you need to do it is exactly the same information we need to adjust discount rates. But if you're willing to do it, you could take every expected cash flow and replace it with this guaranteed cash flow. Now, let's finish the process. If your cash flows are now guaranteed, what discount rate should you apply on them? You discounted the risk-free rate. And if you do it right, and you've got to take my word for it on this, you should get roughly the same value. Here's what you cannot do. You can't mix and match the two where you take, and I see this people doing this, sometimes taking expected cash flows for a risky company and haircutting the cash flows. You know what that means? They'll knock off, why I'm feeling uncertain. And then they will discount those cash flows back at a risk-adjusted discount rate, in which case you're double counting risk. If you're doing discounted cash flow valuation, that's why you shouldn't be using conservative estimates or I feel good estimates, because then you're double counting. And I'm going to do one other tangent here before we leave this page. Some of the most deadly damage done to intrinsic valuation comes out of Omaha. Because what happens is, Warren Buffett says something during a meeting, and people take what he says, and it's like the gospel. He said it, therefore it must be true. So sometimes when I do this session, somebody says, but Warren Buffett says he uses the risk-free rate to discount cash flows. And he said that actually. He says, I don't believe in this risk adjustment. I use the risk-free rate to discount cash flows. He doesn't say that very much anymore because the risk-free rate has gotten so low, but he used to say that. He said, well, if Warren Buffett says that, must be right. And I said, have you ever looked at what Warren Buffett discounts? Warren Buffett uses a measure of earnings called owner's earnings, which is earnings plus depreciation minus capex, which is like a cash flow. And he takes only that portion of the earnings that he says he can count on. Those are the words he uses. So in other words, what's he doing? He's taking the cash flows and he's counting only those cash flows he thinks he can predict and are solid. He's ignoring what he calls speculative cash flows. What's he effectively doing to the numerator? He's risk adjusting the numerator. Here's what you can't do. You can't project cash flows in Tesla with 100% compounded growth rate and then discount those cash flows at the risk-free rate because that's what Warren Buffett told you. Because then you're mixing up two approaches that don't go together. So most of you will take the first approach, but if you ever see somebody talking about, I'm adjusting the cash flows for risk, probe them and what exactly they mean by it. Because most of the time, they're not doing the Howie Mandel adjustment. They're doing an expected value. Expected values are not risk adjusting the cash flows. So let's build on this proposition. So one of the things about valuing companies like Tesla, and I want to value Netflix pretty soon and Amazon soon after, is people don't like the value you attach to the company. And especially with Tesla, they don't like it at multiple levels. And one of the things I'm often accused of being is a theorist. Right after being an academic, this is about as big an insult. You academic, you theorist. And I have to laugh because I know how little theory there is in this class. So let me give it away. This is the entire theory of the class. It's one equation. Because you think about it, what do we spend the next 15 weeks talking about? How to come up with the cash flows and how to adjust the discount rate. You ready? Let's do some intrinsic valuation. 101. Did I do this in my corporate finance class? I don't think I did. So it's actually great. I want to pick somebody who's willing to be my guinea pig. I'll make you look really good, I promise. Anybody want to be my guinea pig? Okay. Have you done valuation before? I want to pick somebody's name. Okay, good. I have an envelope. I have a $20 bill. My sleeves are rolled up, so no. Yeah, so I'm not David Copperfield or somebody, you know. So I'm putting the $20 in the envelope. How much would you pay for this envelope? $20. That's almost always the answer I get. Let me follow up. If you pay $20 for an envelope with $20, what do you get out of this transaction? An envelope, which I stole. As I walked by the desk of somebody, I pulled this up. So first rule in valuation, if you know the value of something, never start your bidding at that number. Start it at a dollar. You don't know what disease I have. Maybe I can't read numbers. That's asking for a lot, but you never know. Maybe I'm dyslexic. Maybe I have trouble just figuring out what currency this is. Now, it's true, this is the simplest of all assets. And if I open, even a banker shouldn't have trouble with this. No? And if I did open this up for bidding, at the end of the auction process, my guess is we're going to converge on 20. Right? So let's say we've converged on 20. We're now in equilibrium. The economists love that word. We're in steady state. Now I'm going to make that equilibrium a little unstable. Can you read to the class what this says? Control. I'm now putting control into this envelope. You have $20 plus control. The old bidding stopped at 20. I've added control to this. How much would you pay for this envelope now?
Value the control,
25. Give me the 25. What are you? This is exactly what happened about a year ago. I was at Goldman Sachs doing a re-education class for their seasoned bankers, partly because they'd forgotten all the basics. And one of the bankers did exactly this. He offered me 25. I sold him the envelope. He said, I didn't really mean it. I said, now that it's your own money, you feel the pain, right? Because think, were you a banker in a previous life? Okay. Because think of what he just paid $5 for, a 3x5 card that I wrote the word control on and put in there. It cost me absolutely nothing because I stole the card as well. Now that we're going on this, might as well keep going. What does it say?
Synergy,
that's a big one. I put it in there. I wouldn't bore you, but what does this say? Your
brand name.
Lots of users. Big data. Networking benefits. I call these weapons of mass distraction. You know why I call them weapons of mass distraction? Because they come out after you valued a company. And you know why they come out? They want you to pay more, or will they justify paying more? Synergy, control, brand name, users, great management. And of course, the ultimate weapons, you've heard me beat up on these two words, are first, strategic. You know what that means. The numbers don't fly, but I really, really, really want to do this deal. And for a long time, the final, and this was the ultimate weapon of mass distraction, if I still have it, was this one. What does it say?
China.
You value a company, you come up with $10 billion, and you want somebody to pay $100 billion. Nothing's working, and here's what you do. You say, we're going to be in China. Another zero pops out. I'll send you the link. I wrote a post on these weapons of mass distraction. I went through words like this, and I had a little experiment where I picked up a dozen. It's not a study because it's not detailed. I picked up a dozen equity research reports, and I counted the number of times the word strategic, China, synergy, control showed up. And it had a loose correlation between the number of times people use these words and the quality of the report. And guess what you find? The less you have to say, the more you start using the word strategic, China. So if you really want to sell something, there's a real option investment which is strategic in China. You pretty much can get through almost any investment you make. So I'm going to state my first proposition. It's called the it proposition. If it does not affect the cash flows and it does not affect risk, it cannot affect value. What's it? You name it. In fact, let's step back. Forget about this 20% control premium that M&A bankers apply when they do acquisitions. And if you ever worked in M&A, this is like routine. You added the company, attached 20%. Where did it come from? I don't know. What is the real value of control? What happens? What's the real value of control? Somebody give me a shot. First, when you say control, what are you saying? I will run the company instead of the existing management, right? That's basically what control is. And to value control, then what do I need to do? I need to value the company twice. Once with the status quo, the existing management, and once with you in place, that difference is the value of control. Could it be worth 20%? Absolutely. The worse managed a company is, the greater the value of control. Can you even imagine what the value of control of the New York Knicks would be? I mean, the Dolans are about as if you could pick three people at random from an insane asylum and put them in there, and they couldn't screw it up more. The value control is going to be immense. You could probably say the same thing about the Mets. The deal fell apart at the Mets? Steve Cohen was going to buy the Mets. But you know why the deal fell apart? Because as part of the deal, the Wilpons wanted to continue to run the team for the next 5 years. And if you're Steve Cohen, you're saying, are you crazy? The reason I'm buying this team is you're so dysfunctional and you want to keep running the team for the next 5 years? So if you're a Mets fan, I'd go to sleep for the next 5 years, wake up, and maybe after the fifth year, somebody would have bought the company. So if you have a business that is badly managed and badly run, the value of control can be immense. But if you have a company that's already perfectly managed and perfectly run, what's the value of control of the company? It's zero. Seeing where did the 20% come from? Who knows? It's completely absurd. It doesn't make any sense. When you get to the M&A, I'll give you a loose rationale for where the 20% comes from. It's a terrible rationale. But if control is value, it's got to show up in the cash flows. It's got to show up in the discount rate. What's the value of synergy? Don't give me the 1 plus 2 is 5 crap that, you know, you see thrown around. What's the value of synergy? The two companies coming together are able to do something they could not have done. Keyword is could not have done as standalone companies. A little later in this class, I'm going to try to value synergy in the InBev-SAB-Miller merger. Largest brewer buys the second largest brewer. Talk of synergy filled the air. I say, okay. And to show the synergies there, to show the cost cuts that 3G Capital wanted to make in the combined company. And you know what? I can estimate the cash flows, the risk, and come up with a value of synergy. What's the value of a brand name?
The amount more someone will be willing to pay for it.
I'm sorry, what?
The amount more someone's willing to pay.
On what? On your product. Exactly. The essence of a brand name is you get to charge a higher price for exactly the same product. You want to see brand name at play? Go to the Duane Reade that's at the end of the street. Walk to the painkiller section. Check out the aspirin prices. There's Bayer aspirin. And right next to it, there's generic aspirin. Just check out the ingredients in case you're suspicious. It's the same damn thing. It's been off patent for 100 years. And then check out the prices. That is pure brand name power. So where does brand name show up? It shows up in margins. And if it shows up in margins, it's in the cash flows. It's in the value. We will value Coca-Cola's brand name. This is a company that puts crap and sugar and coloring into water, carbonates it, and is able to have, what, $100 billion valuation. This is pure brand name power. And finally, what's the value of having lots of users? It depends. MoviePass, what's the value of having lots of users? You go bankrupt sooner. Why? Because your users cost you money. You charge $9.99, and then let me watch as many movies as I want. You're not going to last long. But what's the value of a user or a subscriber to Netflix? You can come up with a value. It depends on how much revenue you get from that subscriber, how long-term that revenue is, and what it costs you. You can value a user. But you have to do your homework. And finally, what's the value of China? What is it that makes China so much more interesting than the Czech Republic? It's, forget about the growth, it's 1.2 billion people. I've always wondered why India doesn't make it onto that list, but that's a different argument, a different debate to have. You got a billion, we should be competing. Maybe that's why population control is not working, and maybe they're going for the highest number there. Okay. But it's numbers. And you know why it makes your value go up? And say, I'm going to sell refrigerators to 1.2 billion people. Your eyes pop out of your head. 1.2 billion refrigerators. You know. It's the size of the market. Where does it show up? It shows up in your projected market size. There is a value to being in China, but you got to flesh out the rest of the story. How much of a market share? What you could be growing in China, but if you never figure out how to make money, guess what? China is a big market, but it doesn't have to be a market that creates value. You give me a word. My job is to find the cash flow. So you talk about great management, brand name. I'm going to try to find a number that goes with it. The it proposition. The second proposition is what I call the duh proposition. It's named after my daughter, who used this word on me consistently through her teenage years. It's a dad, duh. Right. In fact, it got so bad I stopped talking for about 2 years. Yeah. She actually was, I have four kids, three sons and a daughter. My sons lost all interest in my existence on the earth around the age of 11 or 12. They got so self-absorbed. My daughter was obsessive about tracking how stupid I was getting and letting me know. So she said, Dad, duh. Anytime I opened my mouth, I wouldn't even have said a thing. You know, it's a preemptive duh. So I'm going to use the duh on a particular subset of questions I get about valuation. There's about half a dozen every week. Here's how they'll go. I'm valuing a money-losing company. I expect it to lose money forever. What kind of valuation model do you think will work best on putting a value in this company? So let me get this straight. You have a money-losing company. You expect it to lose money forever. Why would you put a value on this company? They should be paying you. So if you came to me with MoviePass 2 years ago, how much would you pay for the company? I say, are you kidding me? You pay me. And maybe I'll take the stream of liabilities you created for the rest of eternity for me. So if you're doing a discounted cash flow valuation, you start estimating cash flows, you're negative, 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 as far as the eye can see and beyond, just let it go. Which leads me to my third and final proposition. If you have a company with negative cash flows up front, and for some of you that'll happen, you compute the cash flows last year, they're negative, year one they're negative, year two, don't freak out. This company could still be a valuable company if it gets disproportionately large positive cash flows in the future. You think that's a very odd company? Not really. In fact, for many of you, this is exactly what you're going to see when you do evaluation. You know what kinds of companies have negative cash flows up front and positive? Any young company, right? In fact, Amgen is a biotech. Its cash flows are big and positive. It's young companies, young biotech companies, young automobile companies, young technology companies. And why are their cash flows negative up front? First is they're not making much money yet on their, and they're spending huge amounts to create future growth. It's a feature, not a bug, to have negative cash flows up front if you're a young growth company. So when you see the valuation of a young company, whether it's Casper or Tesla, if you see positive cash flows right from the beginning, you know somebody's lying. It's either not a young growth company or the cash flows can't be right. This is why when Musk keeps saying we're cash flow positive, it doesn't make any sense to me. Given the story you need for Tesla to become a huge company with great value, I can see a pathway where they can sell as many cars as Volkswagen and it could pull it off. But to do that, there's no way you can be cash flow positive for the next 10 years. You've got to build those assembly plants. So file these away because they're going to lie at the foundation for what we're going to do. So let's start to talk specifics. When I come to you and ask you to value a company, you have to make a choice. You can either value the entire business, which is, think of it as valuing the asset side, existing as well as future growth, or you can value just the equity in the company. Sounds like I'm playing on words. What's the big difference? Let's focus on valuing equity. Let's play a game. Let's suppose I start a business. You guys be the bank. I borrow money from you. You guys be equity investors. I raise equity from you. I start the business, and I start to do well. Cash flows start to come in. Who gets first claim on the cash flows? You do, in the form of interest payments and principal payments. I pay you. And if there is any cash left over, it's an F, what are the three things I can do? I can pay a dividend, I can buy back stock, or I can just hold your cash, hoping that something will come in the future. But both of you get cash flows in the business, right? You get in the form of cash flows to equity, let's call it, and you get in the form of interest and principal payments. And there, when I do equity valuation, I keep my focus entirely on you guys. I say, look, I don't care about the bankers. They can take care of themselves. I'm going to focus on the cash flows you get as equity investors, which are the cash flows left over after debt payments. And I'm going to discount those cash flows back at a cost of equity. You're saying, what the heck is a cost of equity? Why did you buy my shares or invest in my equity? I hope it wasn't because you felt sorry for me. You did it because you wanted to make a return, right? 12, 15, 18. What's that going to be driven by? How risk-averse you are and how much risk you see in me? That is the cost of equity. You can see mechanically estimating this is going to be a bit of a nightmare for a publicly traded company, but we'll hold off on that. But I can take cash flows to equity, discount the cost of equity, and come up with the value of equity. And if this is a publicly traded company, I can take a very strict view of cash flow, saying the only cash flow you get to see as an equity investor that comes from the company is what? Dividends. Everything else is kind of illusion, right? The dividend discount model is a special case of an equity valuation model. And I told you, discounted cash flow valuation can be traced back to a paper in 1938. The dividend discount model was the first discounted cash flow model out there. It's an equity valuation model, focused on equity. You're saying, what other valuation can I do? I can value the entire business. When I'm valuing the business, I'm asking you to think of the lenders as your partners. After all, you both provided capital. You both got cash flows. The collective cash flow you get from this business, cash flows to equity and cash flows to debt, a pre-debt cash flow, is the cash flow I'm going to discount. But now I can no longer just discount at the cost of equity, which is what you guys wanted. I have to bring in what you demanded, which is your interest rate or cost of debt. That weighted average in corporate finance, of course, is the cost of capital. Cash flows to the business discounted at the cost of capital gives you the value of the entire business. Let's say I'm still interested in just the equity in the company. If I value the business, how do I get to the value of the equity? All I need to do is subtract out what I owe you guys, the debt, and I get a value for the equity. So I'm going to start with a pretty mechanical question. I want to direct it to somebody who did DCF as part of their prior lives. I assume that this is something that you had to do over and over again. Let's say you discount cash flows to the firm at the cost of capital. You come up with the value of the entire business. And you're thinking about the debt to subtract out to get to value of equity. I'm going to give you four choices. And for the moment, I'm going to leave the answer kind of fuzzy, but we'll come back and nail this down because it's going to make a difference. Should I subtract out the value of long-term debt alone? Should I subtract the value of all debt? Should I subtract out the value of anything that I might call debt in my cost of capital because I might be including other things in debt? Or should I subtract out the value of all liabilities, which would include accounts payable, supplier credit, etc.? Let's start ruling out. There are two there that you should never be using. Let's rule those out. What are the two that should never be used? You should never be subtracting out all liabilities. You know why? Because accounts payable, supplier credit are parts of working capital. They show up in your cash flows. So don't go around subtracting the mass. And you should not subtract out just long-term debt because if you do, you've given an invitation to companies to play games with you. Do you see why? Because you tell a company, look, I'll subtract our only long-term debt and I compute the value of equity. All of a sudden, they're going to be doing recapitalizations where they take the long-term debt and replace it. Look, I have no long-term debt at all. So really, it's between B and C. And I'm going to argue that the answer has to be C because once you've made a choice on what you call debt for your cost of capital, and when I compute debt for cost of capital, I use lease commitments and maybe other contractual commitments, I'm stuck with that. I can't just suddenly change my mind later in the game and say, I'm going to go back to a different definition of debt. So the answer is C, but we'll come back. There are some new answers there that we have to deal with, but we have to come back to that. But let me ask you a more generic question. There are two ways I can attach a value to your equity. I can do a direct valuation of equity, cash flows to equity, discount back at the cost of equity, come up with the value of equity, right? Or I can value the entire business and subtract our debt to get to the value of equity. So I'm going to ask you two questions, and your answers might be different. Should I get the same value for my equity using both approaches? Or would you like to get the same value for equity? I certainly would, and here's why. Let's suppose I go to work at, you know, whatever, equity research, and my managing director says, put a value on this equity, and I come back and say, I have two values for your equity. When I used an equity valuation model, I got $1 billion. It looks expensive. But when I did a firm valuation subtract out of debt, I got $2.5 billion. Why don't we put out two recommendations? Buy if you do an equity valuation, sell if you do. It doesn't quite work, right? If you want something to work, you got. And I'll give you the good news. If you do it right, you will get the same value for the equity. But doing it right, and this is the bad news, is really, really, really difficult to do. Remember I told you there was going to be a weekly challenge every week? I'm going to send you the weekly challenge for this week on Wednesday. And it's going to be built around this premise of, hey, what's the value of equity? How do I decide? Why are the two approaches giving me different answers? Because if you can figure it out, you're starting to see the implicit assumptions you often make when you do valuation. So I'm going to do a very simplistic example to show you that the values of equity will be the same with both approaches. I'm cheating when I do this, and you're going to see why I'm cheating, because I'm making some assumptions behind the surface that you don't even see. So here's what the example looks like. I have a company. I've projected out the cash flows to equity. Remember, they're after debt payments. I added the interest expense are the only cash flows to debt at the cash flow of the firm. So I have cash flow to equity, cash flow to the firm. Remember the rule, cash flow to equity. I discount back at the cost of equity, which is 13.625%. The cost, cash flow to the firm, I need a cost of capital. To estimate the cost of capital, I'm going to give you two numbers. One is the cost of debt, pre-tax, 10%. This company has a 50% tax rate. So it's after-tax cost of debt is going to be 5%. And I'm also going to give you the market values of equity and debt. Why do you need that? Because to compute the cost of capital, you need weights. And the weights are supposed to be market value weights. So you ready? This is the cheating page because, as I said, I've set up this problem to deliver the result I want. But if I discount the cash flows to equity at the cost of equity, what I get as a present value is $1,073 million. So it's an equity valuation. Alternatively, I can take cash flow to the firm and discount it back at the cost of capital. So get the cost of capital, I take a weighted average of the cost of equity and the after-tax cost of debt. cost of capital. I get a value of 1,873. You subtract out the 800 million in debt. Magic, I get the same value for equity. So if you do it right, you should get the same value. So here I'm going to state a principle that I'm going to come back to over and over again. The key to doing good discounted cash flow valuation is to stay consistent. You tell me how you compute your cash flows, I'll tell you what discount rate should go with it. If your cash flows are cash flows after debt payments, cash flows to equity, your discount rate should be a cost of equity. If they're before debt payments, it should be the cost of capital. And if you do it right, you should get the value for equity that you out of either approach, that should be a good valuation. It's one of the first principles in valuation. We're doing it in what, session three? We have 23 more sessions to go. You think that people who practice valuation, this must be like second nature, right? You check for consistency. So this is where that start of the class test I gave you is going to come in. So what I'm going to do, actually, is I'm going to pull up a page, and then we're going to talk about what this page tells us about the practice of valuation. So let me provide the background for this page. This is first a page from a Harvard Business School case. You know what happens in every Harvard Business School case? No matter where it starts off, finance, marketing, it ends up as a strategy case. Right? Because that's what they like to talk about. So it was never meant to be even talked about because you were supposed to. So this is the background. This was a company called Kennecott. It was a copper mining company that had been forced to divest itself of a coal subsidiary called Peabody Coal by the antitrust laws. So it sold the subsidiary. It got about $600 million in cash on the sale, which arrived on its balance sheet. And immediately, Kennecott decided they had a problem. They had too much cash on the balance sheet. You see, what's the problem with having cash? They were worried that they would become targeted in an acquisition. Why? Because an acquirer could use the cash to fund it. Let me ask you a question. If you have $600 million in cash as a company that you have no use for, what's the most sensible way to get rid of that cash? Give it back to the stockholders, right? That thought never even crossed their minds. They said, what would they do with this cash? Stupid things like pay bills, buy houses, cars. No, we can't allow that to happen. Let me ask you a second question. What's the stupidest way to get rid of cash quickly? Call a banker and say, guys, we have $600 million. Can you find something we can spend it on? This is like walking to Bloomingdale with $5,000 in cash. See, I have to spend this money by 3 p.m. Can anybody help me? They work on commissions. You're going to get a lot of salespeople around you. So this is where it gets interesting. Kennecott goes to First Boston. At that time, the leading M&A bank on Wall Street. They say, can you help us spend the money? And they said, yes, we can help you. And a few weeks later, they come back and say, this might be pure coincidence, but we found the perfect target company for you. And guess what? It costs exactly $600 million. Here's another rule. You go to a bank and say, this is how much I have to spend. Magically, the target company's pricing will expand to take away whatever that cash is. And the rest would have been more M&A history. And they've gone into a Harvard Business School case, and they've talked about the strategic fit of a copper mining company buying it. The target company is a company called Carborundum, and man makes abrasives, you know, sandpaper, metallic abrasives, and whether they fit together. But they made a mistake in that case. They actually put the cash flows that First Boston forecast to justify the valuation as one of the exhibits. Now, my guess is when this case was taught, nobody even looked at this exhibit because who cares? Strategic fit, no, who cares about price? So I'm going to take you through how First Boston computed the cash flows, and I'm going to ask you a very specific question at the end about discount rates. So I want you to focus on how the cash flows are being computed. First, they started with net income. That was a measure of earnings. They added back depreciation. They subtracted out CapEx. They factored in changes in working capital. Then they factored any debt payments they have to make. So they started with net income. They added depreciation minus CapEx, minus debt payments they have to make. That's how they computed cash flows. That's all the background you need, because now I'm going to ask you what discount rate to apply on the cash flows. So these are the cash flows that First Boston has computed for Carborundum. And I'm going to give you six possible discount rates you can use. One of them is the right number, and there are five wrong numbers. So I'm sorry, if you're going to guess, you're only about what, a 16% chance of being right. So here are the choices. First, you have the acquiring company, Kennecott. You've got the target company. And you will create a blended company after the merger. So there are three companies. You can have a cost of equity or cost of capital. So let's start with the easy part of this. Given how the cash flows were estimated, should I be using a cost of equity or a cost of capital? And what is it about the way I computed cash flows that made you use the cost of equity? It's after debt payments. In fact, any time you see cash flows start with net income, that's already a trigger, though some people do screwy stuff like add back interest times 1 minus T, et cetera, et cetera. You start with net income, you subtract out debt payments. It's a post-debt cash flow. Therefore, so you can cross a line through the cost of capital. Now comes the question that I'm going to use to decide whether you should ever go into M&A. I don't have that power, but if I had that power, this is where I would stop you. Three costs of equity, right? Should I use the acquiring company's cost of equity? Don't put your hand up yet, or don't say anything yet. Target company's cost of equity, blended company's cost of equity. I'm going to give you a minute to think about it, because this is going to mean your future in M&A. Acquiring, target, blended. How many of you think I should use the acquiring company's cost of equity? Okay. And you're not alone. Half of all M&A, that's what you do. And what's your rationale? It's your money, right? It says cost of equity, cost of capital. This is, and you think, I'm raising the equity. It's my cost of equity. Let me carry you through. Let me make you my guinea pig on this one. So let's say I come to you with a really risky company and use your cost of equity to value that risky company. What are you going to find? The risky company is going to look cheap to you. You see why? Because you've taken my cash flows, discounted back. You're going to essentially buy my company thinking you got a bargain. In effect, what have you done? You've subsidized me for the fact that you have a nice, safe business. Do you see what this is going to lead you to? The end game here is going to be AT&T in the 1990s and GE by the time you got to, because this is exactly how they got to where they were, because over time, you're going to keep overpaying for risky companies. You're saying, don't mistakes average out. Your mistakes are all in one direction, right? Because it's not the safe companies that are going to offer themselves that are risky companies. Remember in capital budgeting when we did corporate finance? Remember the Disney theme park example? I know you don't, but act like you do. I asked you, what discount rate would you apply to discount the theme park cash flows? What was the answer? It wasn't Disney's corporate cost of capital. It was the theme park discount rate, because your risk, the discount rate should reflect the risk in your cash flows. I told you, half of all acquisitions fail at this very first level. It's not the acquiring company. It's not the blended company, because then you're just subsidizing a little less, but it's still subsidizing. It's always the target company's risk profile that drives your cost of equity. We'll talk about how to value synergy, because then you could make an argument that the combined company kicks in, but value the target company, it's always it. Which in this case would have been 16.5%. So that's the number that should have been used. Let me ask you a different question. If you were to pick the worst possible choice here, where would you go? You'd pick a cost of capital, and you'd pick the acquiring company's cost of capital, right? Guess what First Boston did? They used a 10.5% cost of capital, which gave them a value of $650 million, which justified the $600 million price. But if I'd taken their cash flows, wouldn't even have contested a single cash flow and said, hey, guys, you should be using a 16.5% discount rate on that, the value you'd have got would be $400 million. But the scary thing is, the acquisition went through. They got a deal fee. You know who ran First Boston in the late 70s? It was co-headed by two men called Bruce Wasserstein and Joe Perella. And this should tell you something about how bad valuation gets punished on the street. You know how they got punished? They created a boutique investment bank called Wasserstein Perella, which further demolished the practice of valuation over 20 years. And they did so badly that Dresner Bank, the German bank, bought them out for $2 billion. And I can't make up this stuff for their valuation expertise. There's no justice in this world. You know what Bruce Wasserstein's nickname was, right? Does anybody know? Bid 'em up, Bruce. In fact, when you know, one of his deals, he was asked, you know, whether he was worried he was paying too much. You know what his answer was? My job is to get the deal done first and worry about value afterwards. And he's now passed on, but I hope on his tombstone, these are the words he put. You know, did the deal first, worried about value afterwards. What is that going to do for you? The reason I bring this up is often you see a name on a valuation report. And it's a big name, Goldman Sachs, KKR, Blackstone. And you assume that because the name is up there, somebody must have made sure that this... Don't assume that. I don't care whose name is on a report. Do your own homework. It's simple, right? Just check to see other cash flows before or after debt payments. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. Then check to see what discount rate is applied in them. And we'll talk about other consistency tests. What currency the cash flow is in, the discount rate has to mean the same currency. Check for consistency. Because if you mismatch, okay, where is it? If you mismatch, you are going to misvalue the company. In fact, put an X on this page because during the quiz, you don't want to end up on this page and end up doing what you... This, I've looked at every possible mismatch. I've taken cash flows to equity and discounted the cost of capital. Don't do that because if you do it, you're going to overvalue the company. You can take cash flows to firm and discount the cost of equity, in which case you're going to undervalue the company. If you forget to subtract out debt, no, it gets even worse. You'd be amazed at how many valuations fail at this first test. Are they consistent? You don't even have to check assumptions. None of the hidden assumptions. Basically, just check for consistency. Any questions on consistency? So let's set the process up. What we're going to do over the next 12, 13 sessions is talk about the process of discounted cash flow valuation. We're going to start off talking about discount rates. We're going to start that discussion today. Then we're going to move on to talking about future, you know, getting the earnings and cash flows from last year. Before we get ambitious, let's get that nailed down. And then in step three, I'm going to ask you to leave your comfort zone. Why? Because I'm going to ask you to make predictions for the future. And you're going to fight and scream saying, no, no, it's too uncertain, too speculative. But you have no choice, no matter what company you're valuing. And finally, to get some closure in this, I'm going to assume at some point my company becomes a stable growth company. And you're going to see mathematically why I need to make this assumption, because if I don't, I cannot get closure. Then I would pick the model that's right for you. So we're going to spend some time on each of these. But before we do that, let's look at the big picture here. No matter how you structure a discounted cash flow model, here are the ingredients you're going to see. You're going to see cash flows. Those cash flows can either be before debt payments, in which case they're to the firm, or after debt payments, cash flows to equity. You're going to see discount rates, which can either be to the firm, cost of capital, or to equity, cost of equity. You're going to see a growth rate, which can be either an operating income, which is what goes with firm valuation, because you're looking at pre-debt earnings, or net income earnings per share, which is equity earnings. And then you'll have closure in every single model. Let me explain the need for closure. What's the value of an asset reset in the discounted cash flow world? It's the present value, the expected cash flows on that asset, right? So if I come to you with a 10-year asset, you project cash flows for 10 years, you discount them back, maybe you'll have a salvage value, and you take a present value. That's a discounted cash flow valuation of a 10-year asset. But if I ask you to value a publicly traded company, here's your problem. You look at the corporate chart, it tells you when the company was founded, but it doesn't tell you when the company is going to be wound up. So in theory, what do you have to do? Estimate cash flows forever. Think of it as an Excel spreadsheet that never ends. No wonder people said, can I stop now? Can I stop now? And I'll give you a way of stopping, but you're not going to like the assumptions you need to make to stop. If you're willing to assume that beyond a point in time, you're 5, you're 10, your cash flows grow at a constant rate forever, you can stop, and here's why. If your cash flows grow at a constant rate forever, after a point in time, you have an infinite series in mathematics. Your cash flows grow at 2%, your discount rate is 8%, and 200 years ago, mathematicians solved for the value of that series. We stole that equation, and we act like we invented this in finance. This is the equation that you see as the terminal value equation. The terminal value equation is just a way of putting closure, but the price I extract from you for using that equation is you can do it only when your cash flows are growing at a stable rate forever. Now, do you remember I asked you, when will your company be a mature company? Let me close the loop. A mature company is one that grows at a rate less than or equal to the growth rate of the economy. You see the connection between the two? If you tell me your cash flows will grow at a constant rate forever, by definition, it has to be less than or equal to the growth rate of the economy. So when I ask you, when will your company be a mature company? It's not because I'm navel-gazing and just intellectually curious. It's because that's when I can stop estimating cash flows and estimate a terminal value. So that's what every discounted cash flow model looks like. So you're saying, how come there are dozens and dozens of models out there? Because the cash flow I discount, the discount rate I use, and the growth patterns I adopt might be different for different companies. Let's look at the choices. I said the strictest definition of cash flow is to focus on dividends. Dividends are cash flows to equity, so you discount them at the cost of equity, and you can stop estimating cash flows, and you're willing to tell me your dividends will grow at a constant rate forever. It's a dividend discount model. But the problem with dividends is we know conclusively that companies don't pay out what they can afford to in dividends. How do we know conclusively that companies don't pay out what they can afford to in dividends? How do we know Apple hasn't been paying out what they can afford, what it can afford to in dividends? What gives it away? The fact that you have $250 billion in cash, right? It didn't show up magically. It came from... So when you say big cash balance, is there a signal of, hey, if you focus just on valuing this company with dividends, you're going to undervalue the company. So when you take a Google and you tell me they pay no dividends, so they're worth nothing, I'm going to say, that's silly. They got $120 billion in cash. They must be generating cash flow. So here's your alternative. You can estimate potential dividends. You think that's going to be difficult? I'm going to throw a word out there, and let's see how much you remember of your corporate finance class. Remember free cash flows to equity? What are free cash flows to equity? It's a cash left over after you met every other need. It is what you can afford to pay out. Can I estimate it? Yes. You show me the statement of cash flows for a company. I can tell you what cash flows are left over after every other need. So the second approach to valuation replaces dividends with free cash flows to equity. It's still an equity cash flow, so I discount it back at the cost of equity. And I stop doing this when my free cash flows to equity grow at a constant rate forever. So the only difference between the dividend discount model and the free cash flow to equity model is one, I use the actual dividends, the other, I use potential dividends. And the third approach, instead of looking at cash flow to equity, I look at cash flows before debt payments, free cash flow to the firm. I discount them at the cost of capital, and I stop doing the forecasting when my cash flows of the firm start to grow at a constant rate forever. Keep this page with you, because as you look across models, notice how they have the same ingredients, and the way you estimate the ingredients is going to be different depending on the model that you use. So if I look at a dividend discount model, it's the simplest of all models. Why? Because I've taken the burden of estimation off your shoulders that, trust me, I'm paying out what I can afford to in dividends. The mistake you're making is you're trusting me. You take the dividend and say, okay, if you say so. Dividends become your cash flows. You forecast the growth in dividends, and we'll talk about how to estimate that growth rate more specifically. And because it's a cash flow to equity, you use the cost of equity as your discount rate. So dividend discount model, you've got dividends, cost of equity, growth, and dividends. If I have potential dividends, I have some work to do because now I have to estimate what you can afford to in dividends. Don't worry about the specifics because obviously we're going to come back and talk about how to estimate them. We're going to forecast a growth in potential dividends, and we're going to discount them at the cost of equity still to get a value for the equity. And when I do cash flow to the firm, which is a pre-debt cash flow, the cash flows are before debt payments. The discount rate apply is a cost of capital. But I'm doing exactly the same thing. I'm just replacing the cash flows and discount rates in these different models. So in all of these models, you have a discount rate, right? Whether it's a cost of equity or cost of capital. So let's start there. Let's start with discount rates because without discount rates, you obviously can't do discounted cash flow valuation. So let's start with some basics. We talked about consistency, right? Cash flow to equity, you've got to use cost of equity. Let's re-emphasize that concept and extend it. Not only do you need to be consistent about matching cash flows to equity with cost of equity and cash flow to the firm to the cost of capital, you have to be consistent in terms of currency. And here's what I mean by consistent. You decide to value Gazprom. You can value it in Russian rubles, but if you value it in Russian rubles, your discount rate has to be in rubles, and your cash flows will be in rubles. You could value it in U.S. dollars, in which case your cash flows have to be in dollars, your discount rate has to be in dollars. You tell me what currency you do the cash flows in, I'll tell you the currency your discount rate has to be in. You have to be consistent. If you decide to do everything in real terms, what does that mean? You're not counting inflation in your growth rates and your cash flows, then your discount rate has to be a real discount rate. So in all of this, though, embedded is a principle that your discount rate carries the burden of risk. So I want to spend a little time, not very much, on what exactly is this risk that we're worried about and how do we bring it in. So let me break down a risk-adjusted discount rate into three ingredients. There's a risk-free rate in whatever currency you've chosen to do the analysis in. There's a measure of relative risk of your company. Some companies are riskier than others. And finally, there's a price of risk in every one of your models. And that price of risk is what you will have to pay depending on what investors are demanding in equity markets or bond markets. Risk-free rate, relative risk measure, risk premium. Which of these three should be the most straightforward? Let's get that out of the way. Risk-free rate, right? It should be what, a minute, 2 minutes we should be done? If it's only that easy. So here's what I'm going to do, though, before we go into the risk-free rate. I want to talk a little bit about what exactly are the risks that we build into the risk premium. You see, what do you mean, what risks? It's all risk. Try this as an exercise after you've picked a company. Notice how I keep emphasizing you have to pick a company. Pick a company. And after you've picked a company, start to create what's called a risk profile. It's really, a risk profile is a very cathartic exercise. We say, that worries me, that worries me, that worries me. Start listing them all out. You might have 3 pages of things you're worried about. So with Disney, what am I worried about? I'm worried about the fact that they have the streaming business, Disney Plus. I don't know how much money they will spend. Will the next Frozen movie, what will happen to Anna? All those things. You know, was the snowman melt away? I mean, that's what, $500 million in merchandise. He's never melting. And Anna and Elsa can go, but the snowman has to stay on. You know? But basically, I can list out 3 pages. And after I've listed the 3 pages, or you've listed the 3 page risk, here's what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to put your risk into buckets. Here's the first pairing of buckets. Is your risk estimation risk or economic risk? Let's take Tesla. What's estimation risk? It's things I don't know about the company, right? For instance, I might not know enough about their production facilities in Shanghai. And I might not know enough about, in fact, people told me all the things I didn't know about Teslas, right? There's a Tesla 3 and this is, so there are lots of things. So estimation risk is things that are related to the company that if you collect more information, presumably could go away. You know what economic uncertainty is? It comes from outside. It comes from things you don't control. And no amount of collecting information is going to make it go away. Let me ask you a question. Is the bulk of your uncertainty with Tesla estimation uncertainty or economic uncertainty? You wish it were estimation uncertainty because then what's the answer? Just go collect more information. You collect more information, your answer is going to get more precise. You can try it if you want. But after about 3 or 4% of the risks are dealt with, you're going to see the rest, I don't control. Will it become as big as Volkswagen or as big as Daimler? I have no idea. You know what that also tells me, right? I can do all of the data collection and homework that I want on the face of the earth, but I'm still going to be extraordinarily uncertain at the end of this process. There is this point in risk where you have to take what I call the karmic pose. You know the karmic poses? You say, it is what it is. I'm moving on. There's nothing you can do about it because if you beat yourself up, let me go collect more, you're just going to get frustrated. Estimation or economic uncertainty. Second set of buckets. Is it micro uncertainty or macro uncertainty? What's micro uncertainty? It's uncertainty related to what the company might do, the management might do. Macro uncertainty comes from what will interest rates do, what will the exchange rate do? In the case of Tesla, again, let me ask you the question. Is most of my uncertainty micro uncertainty or macro uncertainty? It's a company where every day there is a micro uncertainty that wakes up and says, please God on Twitter, let this micro uncertainty not show up. This is a company where micro-uncertainty dominates, whereas if I buy Royal Dutch or ExxonMobil or Aramco, in fact, is going to be evaluation of the week tomorrow, the bulk of your uncertainty might be macro-uncertainty. It's not because you don't understand the company. It's what can happen to it, micro or macro. You say, who cares? Micro-uncertainty can be diversified away. You hold 50 stocks, you know, things average out. Macro uncertainty is the uncertainty we bring into discount rates. Micro or macro. And finally, is your uncertainty continuous uncertainty or discrete uncertainty? Continuous uncertainty is uncertainty that hits you every moment of every day. I like to give the example of a U.S. company with European operations. Every time the euro-dollar exchange rate moves, the value of your European operations changes, right? As opposed to what? As opposed to a company that has its investments in the Ivory Coast with a fixed exchange rate. Most of the time, nothing happens. And then when something happens, it's big and it's catastrophic. It's a devaluation. Which do you think is easier to deal with, continuous uncertainty or discrete uncertainty? I'll take continuous uncertainty every single time. I can hedge it, I can bring it into my discount. In fact, everything we know in finance is designed for continuous uncertainty. And I'll use Aramco as a preview for tomorrow. When I valued Aramco, I valued it. You know what it does, right? It's an oil company, gets a bulk of its oil. So basically, an oil company is pretty easy to value. The continuous uncertainty here is oil prices could change, the value could change. That I can live with because I have the same problem when I value Royal Dutch or ExxonMobil. But what is the discrete uncertainty I worry about when I invest in Aramco? The taxes, you know, I can live with. When you invest in Aramco, are you investing in a company or a country? You're investing in a country. Why? Because 80% of Saudi Arabia's GDP comes from oil, and Aramco is that 80%. So that's the first issue. You have country risk. This is country risk coming out of every orifice of your valuation, evaluations of orifices. But you have an even deeper problem. It's not just a bet on Saudi Arabia. It's a bet on the House of Saud, right? Because this is not a traditional company. It's a company that is really an extension of the Saudi royal family. You see where the discrete uncertainty comes here? You wake up to the equivalent. Remember in Egypt, people said, oh, Mubarak is in power. It's constant. Nothing's going to happen. And one day you woke up, the whole thing. And this is your nightmare scenario with Aramco, right? I'm not saying it's a big probability, but that is the risk that I had the most trouble bringing into my valuation. Sometimes just recognizing where risk comes from will let you deal with it better. So we'll talk about how to deal with discrete risk as opposed to continuous risk, but try to do this categorization. Now, carrying on from that concept, the question is, what risk should I bring into my discount rate? So let me make a statement that's going to sound absurd. Not all risk belongs in your discount rate. Not all risk counts. Why? Because some risks can be diversified away. Not hedged away, because hedging is kind of a game you play. Diversification is almost free hedging, because as you spread across, the micro uncertainties you worried about will start to average out. And this is where, when you think about what risk should I bring into my discount rate, there's a question I'm going to ask you. Not how much risk do you see in the company? After all, you and I don't matter in this process. Maybe you do, but I don't. Why? Because we're small investors. What I think about Apple and Apple's risk doesn't matter in the least. So you say, who matters? It's the marginal investor in the company, the people who set prices in the margin. And this is, I think, the revolution that finance brought to the risk view, because they said, look, you can't look at the risk of a company and put all the risk in. It's a risk that an investor who is diversified sees in the company. And one of the questions you've got to ask in valuation is, when I look at my company, is my marginal investors diversified? Not am I diversified, but are my marginal investors diversified? You're saying, who are my marginal investors? I mean, who can afford to own 1 million shares of Apple and trade it all the time? Not you, not I. It's going to be somebody like Blackstone BlackRock or Fidelity or State Street, an institutional investor. And they're not going to own just Apple. They're going to own it as part of a portfolio. So when you think about risk and return models, you're essentially saying, whose eyes do I view risk through? And if you take the perspective of a diversified investor, the way you see risk changes dramatically. You're saying, what if I don't take that perspective? We'll come back and address it, because it is a practical question. But every risk and return model in finance is built on building up to that. Right? So you're looking at, you know, the CAPM, oldest risk and return model in finance. You build every risk-free rate plus beta. Beta measures risk to a diversified investor. Arbitrage pricing models and multi-factor models, think of them as richer versions of the CAPM. So one beta, you have five betas, but you're still taking the perspective of a diversified investor. Even with a proxy model, where you essentially look at our small companies earning lower returns, and how, you are taking the perspective of a diversified investor because those returns come to portfolios. But every one of those models, the constant is you start with the risk-free rate. So I know we're only 6 minutes in, but let's start by looking at the ingredients of the CAPM and break them down. If you look at the CAPM and you cut through all of the baggage you've got to get through the end, the cost of equity for a company is the risk-free rate, the base, plus a beta. And the nice thing about betas is they're scaled around one, so you don't have to do any comparisons to, is that a high-risk stock or a low-risk stock, times an equity risk premium. In arbitrage or multi-factor models, you just have multiple betas and multiple factor models, but the same things we say about the CAPM, beta, and risk premiums apply across those factors. So I need a risk-free rate, I need a beta, and I need a risk premium. And you've told me that the risk-free rate should be the easiest one. So let's start with the risk-free rate. For an investment to be risk-free, you need to know exactly what you'll make guaranteed. You're saying, what if I'm a little uncertain? No, you've got to either know it or you don't. It's either risk-free or it's not. So there are two conditions you need to meet for something to be risk-free. First, the entity issuing the security can have no default risk, because if you have any, even an iota of default risk, it's not risk-free. And second, there can be no reinvestment risk. You remember this from corporate finance? You have a 10-year cash flow. A 3-month T-bill is not risk-free with a 10-year cash flow. Why? Because at the end of 3 months, I've got to invest, and I don't know at what rate. So you're saying a 10-year bond would do? You're getting closer, but you're not quite there, because even a 10-year bond has a problem. Every 6 months, you get a coupon. The coupon is to get reinvested. So if you're a purist, you probably want a 10-year zero coupon treasury rate to come up with a risk-free rate. That's why if you ask me what the risk-free rate is, I can't answer unless you give me two things. One is, over what time horizon? There is no one risk-free rate. A risk-free rate for 3 months and a risk-free rate for 3 years, 5 years, 10 years is going to be different. And in what currency? Is it in Brazilian reais or US dollars? Yeah, it's a good. So risk-free rates, there's no global risk-free rate. That's a mirage. Risk-free rates go with currencies, and they go with the time horizon. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you a series of tests. We'll run through at least the first couple, the easy ones. And then we'll kind of open the doors to more difficult risk-free rate estimation. Let's say you're sitting down to value a company in US dollars. So I have to give you the currency. And this is a valuation of a company where you've estimated cash flows forever. Remember how that happens? You get to a terminal value, it's that terminal value equation. Whether you like it or not, your cash flows go forever. You're trying to pick a risk-free rate to apply to these cash flows. And I'll give you some choices, and you tell me which one of these choices you would use as your risk-free rate. 3-month T-bill rate. What's the problem with it? 3 months. Your cash flows go forever. You can't take a 3-month T-bill rate. You're not matching duration, so you can cross it out. How about a 10-year T-bond rate? Maybe. It's getting longer term. A 30-year T-bond rate? Well, you're getting even more long term. How about a TIPS rate? Do you know what a TIPS rate is? A TIPS rate, you're guaranteed a rate plus whatever the inflation is. So it's almost a guaranteed rate in real terms. And the problem is, you're doing analysis in US dollars, it's enormous. So it's really a choice between the 10-year and the 30-year bond. If I had to pick just the risk-free rate, you know which one I'd go with? Which one is more closely matched up to the duration of my cash flows? My cash flows last forever, and the 30-year bond is closer to forever than 10 years, obviously. I never use a 30-year bond as my risk-free rate for two reasons. One is, the 30-year T-bond has this very strange demand-supply profile. Insurance, Japanese insurance companies hold it. So if you look at the term structure, strange things happen around the 30-year. The 10-year bond is much more liquid than the 30-year bond. Every Monday you get a fresh rate. So that's the first reason. The second is, this is just the start of the process for me, right? What else do I have to estimate? Equity risk premiums, default spreads. You know what? If I pick a 30-year T-bond as my risk-free rate, estimating those numbers is going to get a lot more difficult. Take default spreads. You know how I estimate them? I take the T-bond and I find a corporate bond with an equivalent maturity. So when I...
corporate bond, and I can find a 10-year corporate bond. But if I find do a 30-year T-bond, how many 30-year corporate bonds are you? So the reason I use the 10-year T-bond is because of convenience. It's there, it's easy to use, it makes the rest of my life easier. If you want to make this the place where you want to make your stand and say, I want to use the 30-year T-bond, right? You know what I'm going to say? Go ahead. I'm okay with that, as long as the rest of your analysis tracks the 30-year. So we'll stop there, we'll come back, we'll continue with these mysteries.